I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting KBOO programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And we're leading off this morning with Stephanie Luce on the phone. Stephanie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you for switching things around this morning. We're working out some technical issues, and we'll have Bill Resnick's interview at the end of the program. Stephanie, you are in a labor studies program, and I thought maybe folks might want to know what kind of work you're doing there. You have a long history, actually, as an activist and a movement builder as well, in working around living wage campaigns, and you've written a couple of books, Fighting for a Living Wage 2004, and also, remind me of the second book, my notes are a little scrambled at the moment, here we go, Labor Movements Global Perspectives 2014. So you're busy and fighting the good fight, but you also teach in a very interesting department.
Sure. The labor studies program I teach in includes a master's degree as well as an undergraduate degree in urban and community studies that has an emphasis on labor. And we run something called Union Semester for undergrads and students who have already graduated. And basically, this is just these are classes for people who want to learn more about the labor movement in the broad sense. So it's not just unions, it's worker centers or working class movements and social movements in the U.S. and globally. So I teach things like labor and globalization, labor economics, theories of the labor movement, that kind of thing. So it's a lot of fun.
So in your work, you deal a lot with looking at the importance and power of unions, and you have already been thinking along the lines of what it's going to take going forward. But what's kind of important and somewhat getting lost is that life for working people in the United States has not been good for a long time. And that includes problems inside unions as well as the pressures outside of the unions. So I wanted to kind of start there and get your insights in terms of how unions may have participated in this unfortunate end of this election, because many unions really ran to the gate to support Clinton, while there were some notable departures there, particularly the postal unions. But the union leadership was really on board with Clinton and some pretty unfortunate economic policies.
Yeah, I think the trick of this election is thinking about going back to the last 20, 30, 40 years and seeing that the Democrats have not been a friend to working people on many fronts. So whether it's the promoting trade agreements like NAFTA and Trans-Pacific Partnership, a lot of Democratic leadership has been very reluctant to raise minimum wages. And many have stood by while unions have been very much under attack and not really said anything. So the Democratic Party has been a problem. It hasn't been a party of labor. And there was no signs that that was going to change under Hillary Clinton. At the same time, the unions have, for the most part, continued to cling to the Democratic Party, offering more and more money, staff time, you know, get out the vote efforts, really putting all of their eggs in the Democratic Party basket. And, you know, like you said, that's not true across the board. There was larger unions like the Communication Workers of America that were very active in the Bernie Sanders campaign. But once Clinton got the nomination, the labor movement really didn't have a lot of other, you know, strategies other than working to get her elected. And unfortunately, you know, her issues and her track record just don't speak to a lot of working people. People were pretty discouraged, and a lot of people reported, hey, with Clinton, we're just going to keep getting more of the same. The same has been bad. The same has been, you know, low wages, high underemployment, precarious work. And some people said, well, at least with Trump, we don't know what we're getting. There's a chance it could be better. So the unions have a lot of work to do in terms of building an alternative strategy, how to bust out of this two-party system and this focus on electoral work and really reconnect with a lot of working people, not just their members, but you know, the working class more broadly around building a political movement that can represent those kinds of politics.
I think probably talking a little bit about right to work would be a good place to go, considering that there was a victory and a defeat. And I'll have you remind me what states those were. But there were right to work. I want you to talk about what right to work is, so all of our listeners are able to understand really what that legislation is. Because on the other end of that, with the unions needing to do so much work to regroup and the rank and file needing to put pressure on leadership, on the outside, we may be looking at a Scott Walker Secretary of Labor situation in which a right to work national law could be on their wish list.
Right, right. And I think in the more general terminology, both, you know, in terms of the private sector right to work and what we've, you know, people talk about the Friedrichs case for the public sector, really what the opposition has, you know, people that are opposed to unions have been trying to do is make it that so that it's much harder for unions to require people to pay dues while being covered by the union. So, for example, right now, whether or not you want to be in some states, if you want to be in the union or not, you could be a member or not, but you're still paying dues for the services that the union provides. The union negotiates a collective bargaining agreement that gives you higher wages and benefits, and it also gives you legal protection. And in return, you are paying dues to the union for that service. We've seen increasingly states around the country making that illegal to do that. And, you know, in reality, that momentum was likely to continue no matter who was elected, because that's been on the agenda. With a Trump presidency, it seems like you both do the Supreme Court changes in the administration, changes in the National Labor Relations Board. It looks like we could face a lot of that legislation just coming much more quickly or all at once at the federal level. Now, some people think that in the labor movement think, well, that's a problem, but it's not our worst problem, because what it means is that you go back to a situation where only those workers who really want to be in the union, who are pro-union, are in the union. And otherwise, the union has to go out and knock on doors or go to each workplace and talk to each worker and say, this is why you should be in the union and this is why you should pay dues. So, but what it means is, if these kinds of laws pass, it dramatically decreases union membership in places like Wisconsin. It decreases union treasuries, reduces the number of organizers that can be hired. So it'll be a pretty serious blow if we can base, you know, if we can look to places like Wisconsin and Michigan and see the impact of those kinds of laws.
And Trump has a pretty good sized list of actions he wants to take regarding labor. One of them, interestingly, and I've already had conversations with people about this, is this proposed hiring freeze on all federal employees to reduce federal workforce through attrition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, I've heard people saying, well, we need, you know, people have this perception that there's all of this excess labor in government agencies, and this might seem somewhat appealing to them. But my thought is this is really a backdoor to further destroy public workers and the public sector unions.
Absolutely. I mean, it's another way to also look to privatize some of this work, like TSA agents and in the Postal Service. So there's nothing, there's very little fat on the federal employment level. These are people who provide services that we need. And it's just such a small percentage of the budget anyways. It doesn't even make sense as a monetary attack. You know, I think what's interesting about Trump's proposals for his first, you know, agenda is that, you know, there's some unions and working people that are going to look at that list and say, hey, some of that sounds pretty good. Most notably, stopping the Trans-Pacific Partnership and renegotiating NAFTA. Interestingly enough, those are promises Obama ran on. Obama ran on the promise of reopening NAFTA and no new trade agreements. He went back on that, you know, almost immediately. With Trump, it's hard to say, I mean, it looks already like the Trans-Pacific Partnership may in fact be dead, and that is a good thing for working people, though not necessarily for the same reasons that he's for it. So, but I think that we want to, like, we're going to have to figure out how do we navigate this minefield that Trump may put forward proposals that sound good for people. For example, infrastructure projects, a lot of building trades people are going to think, hey, that's going to mean jobs. But most likely what it's going to mean is, you know, giving subsidies to private employers who then hire, you know, low-wage workers with very bad working conditions. It's going to, there's no guarantee this is going to mean good jobs for people, and it's, there's no guarantee it's going to mean good infrastructure either. So we need to be careful about how we relate to some of the proposals that might go through related to labor that might seem good.
Right. And you actually went exactly where I wanted to go with that. And in fact, you know, it seems like much of what is happening could potentially be a danger in terms of, as we are focusing on trying to beat back all of these attacks, there's going to be a lot of money to be made by some folks. Mm-hmm. And that just seems like, you know, part of the game. And this is Trump's, this is the great Trump, you know, the great businessman Trump at his best, is to, you know, make lots of money off of labor. And I wanted to also note, and maybe you could talk about this, you know, as someone who's also a climate change denier, much of the work, infrastructure work, is not going to be particularly green. It's not going to move us forward and create the kinds of jobs and kinds of meaningful jobs that we could really use in this country.
Absolutely. In fact, most likely it might be the exact opposite. So, I mean, there's so many good proposals out there about creating good jobs that are about retrofitting buildings and making buildings environmentally sustainable, about building kinds of mass transit that's good for the environment. There's so much potential that could be done there. Trump's proposals are going in the opposite direction, talking about things like making new jobs in, you know, the Keystone, you know, approving the Keystone pipeline and those kinds of jobs that are going to actually, you know, they may provide jobs, but it's a short-term job that's totally undermining the environment and creating serious divisions between the people getting those jobs and the impact on the what they're going to do for people's lives.
Stephanie, I wanted to, and I'm talking to Stephanie Luce. She's a professor of labor studies at CUNY City University of New York. We're talking post-Trump and the impact on labor, and we'll get to the juicy stuff. I want to just talk a little bit about protests at the end. But before we go there, in your book, Fighting for a Living Wage, which has been a really large part of your work, is working in and writing about the living wage movement. You mention that one of the real difficulties about living wage is actually getting these ordinances to be fully realized. Mm-hmm. How do you see, in terms of where we've been and where we're going, obviously you can make an easy case for it being much more difficult, but it's mm-hmm. already been hard to get these things implemented.
Right. So, yeah, the work that I've mostly done so far is working with living wage, minimum wage campaigns, and I've made the argument based on studying cities around the world that it could be one thing to get a law passed, and it's a whole other thing to get it enforced, that we cannot look at law as the final answer. It's not like you pass a law and then you're done, that these kinds of campaigns are just part of a larger struggle and organizing project. So you pass a law, but then you need to stay organized to work with workers, to know their rights, to be able to file charges, to have other people with them to file the charges they need to get that through. And so I guess, I would say just what is, you know, in terms of the lessons of this election cycle, I mean, first of all, we saw one of the bright spots of this, if you could even say anything's a bright spot, was that, you know, four new states passed minimum wage laws, minimum wage increases. Two of those include paid sick days requirements, and Flagstaff, Arizona, and Maine are also eliminating a sub wage for tipped workers. So the tipped workers will now be getting, you know, phasing in a full minimum wage. So that highlights that there are issues in which, you know, voters still really want things like higher minimum wage. They want fair trade. They want campaign finance and fair elections. So I think we can still be building movements around those things, but we have to be prepared for, it's not just about the law. It's like just getting the law changed isn't enough. It's really about building the movements that'll make that law a reality.
And there we segue into, you know, these mass protests that have happened around the country and questions about whether or not, for me, I think a lot about whether these protests would have happened had Hillary Clinton been elected, when in fact they need to happen, because everything that we're talking about here this morning is a factor on both ends, whether it's going to be extremely worse under Trump, time will tell. But in terms of the protests, these kinds of actions are very important. And it's also, as you say, important then to move towards something and to be continuing to educate and focus on the great impacts of economic policy in the country, racism and immigration issues, all of it. It's a difficult task, but this isn't really about winners or losers. This is really an opportunity in a moment to try to capture that energy and bring something much more impactful forward.
Yeah. I mean, I think the protests are, you know, I don't think it's likely these protests would have been happening if Clinton was elected. I think these are part a reflection of people's shock and grief and fear, and a need to just be with each other to represent that there was an alternative view out there. In fact, the majority of people that did vote voted against Trump. 70 million people voted against Trump. So I think people are wanting to have their voices heard. You know, fortunately, I don't think that's all we're seeing. I mean, I think the protests are healthy. They're part of democracy, but there's all kinds of organizing work going on alongside that. Reports are coming in from around the country of emergency community meetings that are overflow crowds, 500 people, 1,000 people showing up in their neighborhoods to talk about next steps, organizations getting thousands of new members signing up, coming to meetings, money flowing in to campaign issues. So I'm encouraged by the fact that protests are good, one thing, but it's not stopping there. People are also building the infrastructure they need to go forward. And that's what we need, is we need the voices out there saying that our electoral system at the federal level is absolutely broken. You know, many people can't vote at all. 30 to 40 million people are kept from even registering. Others are not voting because they feel the candidates don't represent anything for them, no change. And we're just in a place where we don't even have the choice to vote for candidates that represent fundamental change. You know, we're facing a global economic, political, and environmental crisis, and we don't have any candidates, you know, we don't have the choice of voting for someone who's going to address those. The system is completely broken.
Yeah, indeed. And this is a great, we have a choice. We have to really see this as a great opportunity. And some of that started with Sanders, but it does indeed need to go beyond that even. So, Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us this morning and for stepping up to the plate for the first interview of the morning, even though I know you're ahead of us a few hours. So, Stephanie Luce, Professor of Labor Studies at City University of New York, thank you again.
Thank you.
We're in the same boat, brother. We're in the same boat, brother. And if you shake one end, you're gonna rock the other. It's the same boat, brother. Oh, Lordy, look down.